From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, for decades, corporate America outsourced. Nowadays, the new buzzword is insourcing.
It isn't an act of patriotism or charity. It's smart business to make stuff here.
Our cover story, why making it in America might be good for the bottom line.
I think there's an awful lot of chatter in the media about the death of American manufacturing. I think we're finding almost exactly the opposite.
And later, the Hillary video tribute that has the political classes chattering, and how the fictional Brontosaurus conquered paleontology.
You know, the idea of Bronto burgers may have perpetuated the idea of Brontosaurus in the public's eye.
Also, Oscar-winning composer Gustavo Santaolalla talks about the movie he could watch a million times, and how actor Keira Knightley channeled Tolstoy's famous character, Anna Karenina.
Everybody's having fair. She's not doing anything that anybody else isn't doing. The problem is that she can't lie about it.
Plus, the DJ behind one of the most popular songs of the year. DJ Calvin Harris and his hit-making machine. That's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Just on the outskirts of downtown Louisville, in an industrial part of the city, there's a factory. It's called Appliance Park, and General Electric opened it back in 1951. And it's so big, you pretty much need a bicycle to get around.
And you rent these bikes to get around your...
maintenance bikes. The whole park's about a mile across. So if you have to go from building to building,
might be nice to take a bike.
Bike helps.
That's Rich Calvaruso.
I'm the lean leader here at GE Appliances.
And we'll get to what a lean leader is in a moment. But first, we asked reporter Devin Katayama to take a tour of the place.
So what are we looking at here? Is this part of the...
And we sent him to a specific assembly line at Appliance Park.
So this is the line that we put in place in April 2009. And this replaced the line that had been here for about 25 years.
It's a brand new line that was built to produce dishwashers, GE dishwashers, made in America. And that line may be a window into the beginnings of what's being called American insourcing. From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. And our cover story today, bringing it back home, is Made in the USA making a comeback. The story of Appliance Park and GE was recounted in a two-part article in the latest issue of The Atlantic. James Fallows, a regular on this program, wrote about the changing face of labor in China, and Charles Fishman wrote about the economics of insourcing. We'll hear from Charles Fishman in a moment, but back to Appliance Park and GE. Back in 2008, Rich Calvaruso gathered his team at the park and told them they had to rethink the dishwasher. Calvaruso, as we mentioned, is called a lean leader at GE. His job is to figure out how to make things more efficiently. So he asked everyone, the factory workers, the designers, the marketers, to put their heads together, and they managed to cut down the time it takes to build that dishwasher by a third.
On the old dishwasher line, the operators would have to manually manipulate the dishwasher to get it in orientation they needed for building it. Very simply, the team kind of used gravity and some simple rails to allow the dishwasher to tilt back so the operators in the next section of the line can do their work and not have to constantly manipulate it. Every time the operator manipulated a tub, it wasted a few seconds. And if we did that multiple times, all those seconds add up.
Even though it now takes fewer people to make that dishwasher, not a single person was laid off. Calvaruso explains that they were freed up to work in other parts of the company. And that process set in motion a company-wide reevaluation of how GE should operate. A new philosophy, the idea that it might make more business sense to have everyone involved in a product work in the same place. And that thinking led to a change that couldn't have happened if some workers were in China and some were in Mexico and some were in the U.S. So here's an example. GE made a dishwasher that was good, but it didn't look good. The marketing team wanted to eliminate four visible screws in the door to make a sleeker-looking machine. So once again, the company assembled a team. Here's Rich Calvaruso again.
And that team had a lot more diversity on it. So it had actually design engineers and industrial designers and marketing and everyone from the whole business on that team. And results in a really good-looking product. But more importantly, it actually eliminated the work of actually having to shoot all those screws.
So all those people are now in the same area, the designers, workers who build the equipment, the marketers who sell the equipment. They're all there in the same...
Yeah, they're all in one big room.
Wow.
They actually have a very large open room. There's no big cubicles, walls. So we took all those out. So it's been a great thing to watch. Like a couple days ago, I was out on the shop floor and I saw one of our hourly associates that's on the dishwasher team. And she was out on the line struggling with trying to assemble one of the new designs. And after she did it for a while, I said, you know, you should just really just go talk to Karen. And Karen Hoff's our design leader for dishwasher. And she says, you know, that's a good idea. I'll just go up and see Karen. So, you know, I walked away thinking, that's really pretty cool, really, that Mary can just walk up to go see Karen and talk about that problem.
Yeah, that is cool. I mean, the person who designed it and then the person assembling it. I wish I had that with IKEA. You know, when I come home with my IKEA box.
Yeah.
Now, this four-screw story, the idea that Mary and assembly conduct a Karen and design, is what's given GE the confidence to invest almost $1 billion in Appliance Park and bring jobs back to the U.S. Now, think about it. Just 4 years ago, fewer than 2,000 people worked at Appliance Park in Louisville, a place that once employed 23,000. But in just 4 years, the number of workers there has tripled, with more coming soon. And reporter Charles Fishman, who wrote about Appliance Park in the latest issue of The Atlantic, doesn't think it's a blip. This past week, Apple announced it'll start producing some of its Mac computers in the U.S. Even the Chinese manufacturing company Foxconn now says it'll expand its operations here. And Fishman sees the four-screw story as a metaphor for this insourcing boomlet.
To me, the power of the four-screw story is no one ever would have known in the old method a year and a half ago that anybody wanted the screws to disappear, that making the screws go away makes the door cheaper, easier to make, and a better product. And that's what that story sort of shows you.
So why wouldn't it have been possible 18 months ago? I mean, why couldn't that four-screw story have happened 2 years ago?
It could have. And for 2 years or 3 years, you've been reading stories about companies reopening U.S. factories or bringing this line of products or that line of products back to the U.S. And none of those stories actually answered the question that was on my mind, which was, why? Why does it make economic sense? What I discovered is it's not clear this huge wave of outsourcing was done for really smart, rational business reasons. People were looking at, I can hire 30 workers for the cost of one American worker. I kind of don't care what my other costs are. This stuff turns out to be really complicated, and you have to sit down and ask a whole set of questions before you understand that you've been making a mistake for a year or 2 years or 4 years.
So it's not just GE. There are other companies that are bringing manufacturing back?
There are dozens and dozens of companies that are bringing manufacturing back. Caterpillar is opening factories in the U.S. Some of that work is coming back from offshore. Otis Elevator is moving elevator manufacturing back from Mexico to the U.S. One reason has to do with intellectual property. All of these products are getting more and more sophisticated. GE now makes a washer and a dryer that are connected to each other and talk to each other. So you can simply take the clothes from the washer and put them in the dryer, and the dryer dries them. You don't have to do anything with the dryer. All of that gives the products, you know, a competitive advantage in the market. But what happens when you make them overseas is that the people making them knock off your products. So one of the reasons for bringing this manufacturing back home is to literally protect the special features that a place like GE or Otis Elevator thinks its products have in another country.
How much of this so-called insourcing boomlet has to do with oil prices or even all the natural gas that's being exploited in the U.S.?
I don't think you can say just wages or just energy prices or just transportation time, but when you stack them up, it really gets to be incredible. So oil prices are three times what they were just 10 years ago. And oil prices are the key in terms of bringing stuff in a big ship from China to the U.S. across the Pacific. Natural gas costs a quarter in the U.S. what it does in Asia. And a huge factory like Appliance Park can rely on natural gas to generate power. And so, you know, it was just one of those wonderful moments when I was talking to the people at GE. It takes 5 weeks from the moment you put a refrigerator or a dishwasher on the ship in China until it gets to the port in California. Then, of course, it has to get from Los Angeles to somewhere in the U.S. I said, so how long does it take to get the product into distribution from this factory? And they just laughed and pointed to a conveyor belt, you know, running overhead in the factory. They said it takes 19 minutes. That's a huge advantage, plus the cost advantage in terms of energy.
Charles, as you point out in your article, some 6 million manufacturing jobs were lost in the decade that began in 2000. Over the past 2 years, about 500,000 factory jobs have been created in the U.S. That doesn't sound like a whole lot. Doesn't sound like a trend, but you say it is?
Yeah, let's put the big numbers in context. There haven't been this few people working in factories in the United States since 1941. There were a third fewer people in the country then. Remarkably, the output of those 12 million people is extraordinary. Because of the recession, we're not quite at the highest dollar value the country has ever produced in manufactured goods, but we're very close. What's very clear is Immelt, the CEO of GE, is spending almost $1 billion to bring this factory and a couple other GE appliance facilities back to life. You don't spend $1 billion on a $5 billion a year business unless you think you're going to be using that $1 billion investment for 10 or 20 years. And if the economy picks up, companies are going to look at what GE is doing and realize they need to do this too in order to stay competitive.
So Charles, for the last 4 years of the recession, we've been hearing about job loss and how those jobs are not coming back. Manufacturing jobs are not coming back to the United States. Is that true?
No, I think a lot of things can still be made cheaper somewhere else. What the people I talked to said is there's going to be different kinds of manufacturing done in different kinds of places. We're never going to see Michigan and Ohio look like they looked in the 60s and 70s. But I also think that this complete sense of resignation that we're never going to make anything in the United States, I also think that is dramatically overstated. And I think smart companies will see it isn't an act of patriotism or charity. It's smart business to make stuff here.
That's journalist Charles Fishman. His article from this month's Atlantic Magazine is called The Insourcing Boom. Charles, thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
By the way, Charles, have you heard of this American company that is making hoodies? American Giant, it's called?
American Giant?
You haven't heard of them?
No.
They're making hoodies.
Okay. I'll look them up. No.
More on that hoodie in a moment. It's been dubbed the best in the world. Now the company's making money, making them here, in the next part of All Things Considered from NPR News. We're talking about the small but significant trend called insourcing, manufacturing things here in the U.S. Earlier this year, Bayard Winthrop opened up a sweatshirt and hoodie business in San Francisco, and he called it American Giant. He's got 10 people in the front office and up to 150 workers in a factory where his entire line, soup to nuts, is made in America. We read about him in an article in Slate this past week, which called his hoodie the best hoodie in the world. And 2 days after that article was published, they sold out of almost everything.
I believe as of this morning, we are almost entirely sold out of all sweatshirts that we make.
Wow.
Which is saying something. We had a planning meeting about a week ago where we thought we were in great shape heading into the holiday season. So it was a pretty overwhelming response.
What makes your sweatshirts different from other sweatshirts?
We strip it down. For us, I think it really did start with a fabric and trying to make a heavyweight, 100% cotton fabric that had a dry exterior hand, a soft internal hand. A lot of sweatshirts today are very baggy and very sloppy. We try to do away with that and have them fit people correctly. A lot of these things, frankly, are the result of big and unwieldy distribution mechanisms, manufacturers trying to build a one-size-fits-all garment for people. Trims and hardware are a big thing for us, looking at our zippers and our grommets and our eaglets and our drawstrings and making sure that each one of those elements of the sweatshirt gets a lot of attention.
So you are doing what a lot of people in your industry would consider to be impossible. You are making clothing entirely in the U.S. and you're actually making money?
Yeah, I think, my whole career, there's always been kind of a belief that the distribution cost, the markup and margin that live between a consumer and the people that are actually making the clothes were sacrosanct. They couldn't be touched. And so we decided to leapfrog that a bit and say, we're going to do away with all the distribution costs.
You're not going to have stores, basically.
Yeah, by getting rid of stores, by getting rid of wholesale partners and say we're going to get as close, get the consumer as close to the manufacturer as we possibly can and just ship directly to them. That was the unlock for us. And that gives us, you know, a lot more investment opportunity to put back into product and service.
I mean, are you able to produce as much as, you know, I don't know, let's say all of a sudden, you know, everybody in America wanted to order one from you. Could you produce on the scale of a Gap or you know, one of these huge companies?
It's a good question. You know, I think there's an awful lot of chatter in the media about the death of American manufacturing. I think we're finding almost exactly the opposite, that the manufacturing facilities that have made it through the last 30 years, which no doubt have been difficult, have come out the far side stronger and more efficient with phenomenal people, talented people, efficient people. And so the short answer is we feel really confident about our ability to scale. So I think it's something we keep an eye on, obviously, but we're feeling pretty optimistic about it.
Have you gotten a hoodie on to Mark Zuckerberg?
You know, we heard a rumor that he was wearing one of our hoodies. We have not actually. We talked about that in the office the other day about whether we should make sure to get one to his office, but we have not is the short answer.
I wonder if he was the guy who bought all the hoodies. You
know, could be.
Yeah. That's Byard Winthrop, the founder of American Giant. Last weekend here in Washington, the Brookings Institution's Saban Center held a forum on U.S.-Israel relations. The Saban Center is named after Chaim Saban. He's a billionaire Israeli-American media mogul and a big-time contributor to the Democratic Party. Anyway, at that forum, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was honored. And before she spoke, Saban arranged for an 8-minute video tribute to the outgoing secretary. In the audience was David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker.
And it was incredibly over-the-top complimentary, almost to the point where at the end of the film, you almost expected Hillary to come on and say, I'm Hillary Clinton and I approve this message.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the State Department. How are you? Come on in.
This is a video full of, like, the who's who of Middle East politics and even some others, Henry Kissinger, Tony Blair.
What makes Hillary Hillary is strength, toughness, very strong streak of principle.
This is, of course, over images of Hillary around the world, Hillary hugging Aung San Suu Kyi and in a hijab. And
she arrives someplace, everybody pays attention.
And doing good works. And look, let's not be, you know, crazily mocking about this. We're being, you know, very politically knowing. But at the same time, by many accounts, this was a passage in her career as Secretary of State that earned her extremely high poll ratings, not just among the international political elites.
I've just had the opportunity to work with her to achieve the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
I have indeed been exposed to the Hillary laugh.
But Tony Blair's line was basically the line that everybody was thinking while watching this movie, and he said, I still think with Hillary,
the best is yet to come.
Yeah! Anyway, this video, it left David Remnick convinced of one thing. Hillary Clinton is running for president.
Look, I couldn't help thinking, knowing what I know about politics, that it's absurd to predict presidential politics 4 years in advance, 2.5 seconds after the election. But you couldn't help thinking that there was this kind of almost international, or at least at a minimum Israeli-American establishment endorsement of her or encouragement for her to run for president. And the combination of the film, the way she gave her speech, which was extremely uncritical of the Israelis, even at a moment when the Israeli-American relationship is, I would say, very troubled, gave one the indication that she is being hyper-careful and looking forward to a career that's still got politics in it. And where is there left for her to go other than a presidential race?
I wonder if many of those people or all of the people interviewed were thinking ahead to 2016 and thinking, we better say nice things about her now because maybe she'll remember us.
I think there's not a single person that appeared on that film that hasn't read Machiavelli.
Bibi Netanyahu at the end.
Included. Very much included.
The Israeli prime minister at the end says, I don't think we've heard the last of Hillary Clinton.
That was the message from everybody, in a sense. That was the subtext from everybody.
Do you think she will simply recycle this ad as her first political ad in 2016? Just ask for permission.
I'm not sure how many votes in Iowa you get from the endorsement from Salam Fayyad or from Bibi Netanyahu.
Who knows?
Well, it's a very small neighborhood in Iowa.
David Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker. He spoke to us from our bureau in New York. David, thanks.
My pleasure.
Remember in the opening credits of The Flintstones, when Fred slides down the tail of that very large dinosaur, the one from the late Jurassic Age? Or if you don't remember that, how about the same-looking dinosaur in this scene from Jurassic Park?
It's a dinosaur.
Okay, here's a better description of that dinosaur, and let's just keep the music in for a moment.
That's about 80 feet long, stands on four huge, massive legs, something like Greek columns, has a long neck and a small head, was a plant-eating dinosaur that lived about 150 million years ago.
So that is Matt LaManna.
And I'm a dinosaur paleontologist at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh.
And when we caught up with him this past week at the museum, he was standing in front of a skeleton of that very dinosaur he just described.
And the plaque in front of it, what does it say it's called? The sign in front of it says it's called Apatosaurus.
Apatosaurus. Ever heard of it? Perhaps, like us, you thought Brontosaurus. Well, it turns out there is no such thing. Try this. Go to Google and look for the Wikipedia entry for Brontosaurus. There is none. You're forced to the Apatosaurus entry. Now, the story of why, that is, goes back almost 130 years to something paleontologists refer to as the Bone Wars.
Well, the Bone Wars were a period in the early history of paleontology here in the U.S., and they're the name given to the competition between a Yale paleontologist named O.C. Marsh and his bitter rival Edward Drinker Cope, a Philadelphia paleontologist. Their dislike for one another and their scientific ambition led them to race dinosaur names into publication and to, you know, to name multitudes of species, mostly to try to outdo the other one.
And they were, I mean, it wasn't just a friendly rivalry. I mean, this was like a deadly rivalry.
It was an unfriendly rivalry, definitely. There are stories of either Cope or Marsh telling their fossil collectors to smash skeletons that were still in the ground just so the other guy couldn't get them. There were definitely back and forths in newspapers, some back and forth in the scientific literature as well. So it was absolutely a bitter, bitter rivalry.
So anyway, in the heat of this competition, Marsh discovered the skeleton of a dinosaur he dubbed the Apatosaurus.
And 2 years later, his fossil collectors that were working out west sent him a second skeleton that he thought belonged to a different kind of dinosaur that he named Brontosaurus.
So that was a mistake, but A few years later,
in 1903,
a third paleontologist figured this out, that they were the same animal.
And so because the name Apatosaurus is older, it's the one that gets used.
And that was it. Scientists already knew in 1903 that there was no such thing as a Brontosaurus, but a full reconstruction of the Apatosaurus wasn't completed until 1979, because paleontologist O.C. Marsh made another mistake a century earlier.
When he published his reconstruction, no skull had ever been found attached to a body of the animal that we now call Apatosaurus. So when Marsh went to publish a reconstruction of this animal in 1883, he used the head of another dinosaur to complete the skeleton.
Now, one thing you are not saying, which is that the dinosaur you are standing in front of actually had the wrong head for a long time, right?
Yes, that's correct, yeah. It did have another dinosaur's head on it for many, many years.
It turns out paleontologists didn't realize that the skeleton had the wrong skull, because very few well-preserved Apatosaurus skulls had ever been found.
And it stood that way from 1932 to 1979, so almost 50 years.
Yeah, but Brontosaurus has been used, like, up until just a few years ago.
Well, Brontosaurus has been used up until a few years ago, definitely in the public eye. And why that is, I'm not totally sure, but I think it has something to do with the nature of the name Brontosaurus itself. Brontosaurus is it means thunder lizard. It's a big, evocative name for one of these huge, you know, long-necked dinosaurs, whereas Apatosaurus means deceptive lizard. It's quite a bit more boring.
I bet the Flintstones had a lot to do with it, though.
You know, that could well be, definitely. The idea of Bronto burgers may have perpetuated the idea of Brontosaurus in the public's eye. Absolutely.
That's Matt LaManna with the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. You can see a photo of that Apatosaurus from 1934 with the wrong skull at our website, npr.org.
On this program, we've been asking filmmakers about the movies they never get tired of watching, including this one from the man behind the Oscar-winning score for Brokeback Mountain.
My name is Gustavo Santaolalla. I'm a musician, composer, producer. The movie that I've seen a million times, but really I saw three times, but for many people probably will seem like a million times, was The Tree of Life, directed by Terrence Malick and starring Sean Penn, Brad Pitt, and Jessica Chastain.
The nuns taught us there are two ways through life, the way of nature and the way of grace.
The movie starts, you know, with this story about this family in Waco, Texas, in the 50s.
Bless this food to our use, and us to your loving and faithful service.
And then, you know, we get to know this tragedy that happened. I mean, and in such a poetic way. I mean, there's really no dialogue or anything through the visuals. You absolutely realize what just had happened, you know. You can tell that one of their kids died.
Why?
When the mother starts talking to God.
Where were you?
I was like totally, totally sucked in. I mean, I loved it. I was raised Catholic, and this movie, there is a connection, I think, with religion and with spirituality. And there's also, I mean, the connection with the possibility of redemption, you know, with the possibility of coming to terms with yourself and with the problems that you might have had with your parents.
Father.
And when he says, you know, Father, Mother, you always wrestle inside of me, and you always will.
Always you wrestle inside me.
We all, I think, in life go through those moments in which we feel inside of us that mom side and that dad side fighting, you know?
Jack, all I ever wanted for you was make you strong, and maybe I've been tough on you. I'm not proud of that.
I mean, I think all those things are so human and related to anybody, anywhere, you know. It doesn't matter what culture are you, or even, you know, what religion you believe in.
Mother, make me good.
I have favorite scenes for different reasons. I will say probably, I mean, the scene where they get the news about the death of their son is a tremendous, powerful scene. The whole thing, the way it's set up, and, you know, first, you know, she coming in the house and getting the letter and opening the letter and suddenly reading that text and breaking down. And then going to the sound of the airplane. I mean, that weight of that pain, the way it's translated in that scene, it really, really moved me. It gives me, you know, I hope every time that I see a movie or I'm exposed to a work of art of this magnitude, I feel regenerated, you know. I feel like I'm happy to be part of this universe, and I'm happy to be in this world. So this movie really pushed once again that concept in me.
That's Gustavo Santaolalla talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. Santaolalla composed the score for the new film, On the Road, which hits theaters December 21st. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Tolstoy's Anna Karenina has been adapted for TV or film at least 25 times. Garbo and Lee have played the title role in the past, and now it's Keira Knightley's turn. She's reunited with director Joe Wright in a new adaptation of the film. Wright set the film on a stage, literally, so that the audience in the movie theater feels as if it's watching a live performance. And it opens with Keira Knightley's Anna getting dressed, as if we're watching an actress backstage before the curtain rises.
Anna finds herself in the role of the perfect wife and the role of the perfect mother, and suddenly that role doesn't fit. So I think the first thing that we did talk about was this idea of her and that opening sequence, her dressing for the role of Anna Karenina. And there was even talk very early on of, do you take it one step further and do you actually see me, Keira Knightley, dressing as the actress, dressing as the role of Anna Karenina? Mm. We thought that would be taking it just one step too far.
Your description of that reminds me of some notes I took when I was watching the film, which was meta. I wrote meta and then meta again, because it's like a play within a movie and then, then Keira Knightley with an Anna Karenina.
And I mean, I think that's what Joe's been fascinated with, that idea of, I think particularly in cinema now, you know, we're used to a very kind of stark naturalism.
Yeah.
Even to the point where, you know, if it's written in the script and she walks to the house, you will see her walking along the road, you will see a shot of the front of the house, you will see her walking into the house, all before you've actually started the scene, which actually just takes place in the house, you know. And I think he was quite interested in breaking that down. Film is fantasy. It is never real. However real we try and make it look, it is always fiction. And so in a funny way, and I don't necessarily completely agree with this, but I totally understand it. You know, I think Joe was looking to sort of say, OK, if you say that this is not reality, does it therefore become more honest, more kind of truthful? And does the fact of labelling it a fantasy and never trying to pretend that it's a reality actually make it more real in a funny kind of way?
When did you first read this book?
I think I first read it when I was about 19, definitely in my sort of late teens, early 20s. And it's really strange because it's the first sort of, I think it's the first novel I've ever reread. And I was totally floored by how different I found it.
Uh-huh.
I remembered it as being, I mean, obviously very lush and tragically romantic and sweeping and all the rest of it. But I distinctly remember her as being innocent. I was entirely on her side. And I was really, really shocked when I came to it again last summer before we started shooting. And totally didn't see her as innocent and found her very difficult and found Tolstoy's, or what I perceived to be Tolstoy's opinion of her, very difficult.
That he was judgmental of her?
That he was judgmental, but also there's like, I mean, and people will hate me saying this and probably completely disagree, but I thought that there was a latent misogyny that was sort of, you know, going on in there, and I was really shocked by it. And possibly because he was judging her, and that I don't think that the role of Anna is that heroine that he's holding up saying, hey, don't we feel sorry for her and she should have the right to do this. I think
so
he's
the
actually,
right to love.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that is in there, but it's not just that. It is actually holding her up as a warning. And I found that fascinating, and I found it was also something that was interesting to play with.
It's interesting because you say the first time you read it, you really, you were on her side. You were you were completely with her, and then you reread it, and that changed. And when the way you portrayed her, you can't totally be with her, but you can't also be unsympathetic. I mean, she's a very difficult character to like and to dislike at the same time.
Or was it that you wanted to spend Sunday with Princess Sorokina?
Please, don't spoil everything. I can't see Mamma tomorrow because she won't have read the papers she has to sign.
In that case, let's not bother. I'll leave on Sunday or not at all.
That's absurd.
It's absurd to you because you have no understanding of my life here.
Anna.
No, you've stopped loving me. You've given up everything for me and it's turned you against me. I lie about
Stop. I put a far departure for a day or two and you tell me I don't love you.
Because I've been living off your love and there's none left. So this is over. Finished.
If you make her totally sympathetic, that is to simplify something that I don't think should be simplified. I don't think anybody in life is entirely sympathetic, you know, and I think that's sort of what I found so terrifying about the character in general, is that I did judge her, I do judge her, you know, and yet you're constantly asked the question, but are you any better than her? Do you have a right to judge? And of course the answer is no, and that's kind of a terrifying realisation. But also a totally fascinating one, and something that we were constantly, you know, we were constantly playing with how far you could take that darker side, because I think sometimes in the book she can definitely be seen as the villain.
I want to ask you about a scene from the film. This is your character's watching her lover Count Vronsky's taking part in this race, and his horse trips up and he falls off, and she screams out, "Alexei!" This is a scene where after the race she's in a carriage on her way home with her husband.
Yeah.
And this is what he says to her.
I have to tell you.
Yes.
I have to tell you, you behaved improperly today.
How is that?
By making plain your feeling when one of the riders fell. Your conduct was improper. It must not occur again. I have said it before. Perhaps I was mistaken.
No. You were not mistaken. I am his mistress.
Why does she admit it? Why doesn't she hide it?
Well, I think one of her most destructive parts in her character is the inability to lie, and she cannot handle the lie. I mean, what's fascinating about that society that she's in as a whole is they're all having affairs.
Everybody is.
Everybody's having affairs. She's not doing anything that anybody else isn't doing. The problem is that she can't lie about it, and therefore she tells him. She goes further than that. She actually says she hates him, which is, I think at that point is true. She is horrendously truthful when she wants to be.
I'm speaking with actor Keira Knightley about the new film, Anna Karenina. You grew up in a theatrical family. Your father's an actor, your mom's a playwright. Did your parents sort of ever help you figure out how to prepare for roles? I mean, was there kind of a ritual, or was there...
No, not really. I mean, my dad gave me my probably one and only acting lesson before I did Pride and Prejudice, where he sat me down, and I was 18, I think, and he sat me down and he went, right, you've been doing really well getting by on instinct alone, but I think you actually need a couple of tools here. So he basically talked me through a bit of Stanislavski and gave me a very, very good note, actually, which I've always said. And he was like, beware of playing anger. He said, anger isn't very interesting. If you think that you're going to go there, really think about it, because maybe there's a more interesting route. And I've actually always held to that because I think he's quite right. But he did give me that piece of advice just before I was going to play Elizabeth Bennet. So, I mean, but that's really the only time.
Do you ask them, or do they give you honest critiques of your performances?
My dad is quite frightening. Yeah. he's one. I mean, no, my mum is endlessly supportive.
Proud and
loves,
yes,
everything.
Right.
Yeah, and wonderful. And I love her for it. My dad, I'm always quite frightened of showing things, because it's not that he would never be brutal at all, but I absolutely know exactly what he thinks. He really liked this one, which was great. But yes, he has been pretty honest in the past.
There's a scene in the film where Vronsky tries to convince you to leave your husband after finding out that you're pregnant.
Here's an end to living in corners, existing day to day on lies.
Yes. Now we can be together.
How can we, Alexei?
Tell Karenin everything.
Do you think my husband will make you a present of me?
Leave him.
Leave him and be your mistress.
Yes. Run away.
I would never see my son again.
Who does Anna ultimately choose? Is it her son? Is it her husband? Is it Vronsky?
Well, I suppose she ultimately chooses Vronsky, although possibly despises him for it in the end. But I think the choice is that. You know, I think the great tragedy of Anna Karenina, apart from the obvious one, but the great tragedy is her inability, once she's tasted romance and perhaps lust for the first time, she cannot recognize love as being anything else. She cannot recognize, for example, the love that there actually is between her husband and herself, and she becomes like an addict. And I think, you know, it's quite understandable. We all know kind of serial romantics, you know, those people that kind of just look for that honeymoon period again and again and again. And I think that is absolutely Anna. You know, once she's tasted it, that is it. And that is the only thing that she can equate love with. And it tears her apart.
Keira Knightley is Anna Karenina in the new film, which is now open in theaters across the country. Keira Knightley, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
And it's time now for music. This is a song by Rihanna. It's called We Found Love, and it hit number one around the world earlier this year. The song was written and produced by a British DJ named Calvin Harris. He's written a string of smash hits for some of the biggest pop artists in the world. Now, not that long ago, Calvin Harris was living with his parents in Scotland, remixing songs for fun on a computer his brother left at home when he went away to college.
I spent more time at home because I was working on music and I forgot to learn any social skills, which was sometimes a problem, but it was okay. I just locked myself in my bedroom and made music.
I mean, you locked yourself in your bedroom, made music, and you say you were socially awkward, but you perform in front of tens of thousands of people. You even sing. I mean, the song Feels So Close, which is a huge hit.
I feel so close to you right now. It's a force field. I wear my heart up on my sleeve like a big deal.
How do you go from being that kid, that kind of socially awkward kid, to being able to do that, to stand in front of tens of thousands of people and perform your music?
It feels like a long time. You know, I first started playing around when I was 14 years old, so that's half my life. You know, I can't really sing. That's another thing. I'm on my third album now. When my first two albums came out, I was kind of like the singer in a band that I made up to present the music that I was making in my bedroom, which was quite an interesting concept. But it worked in the UK, you know, and those records did pretty well. So I had gotten used to a relatively large crowd compared to what I had in my bedroom when I had my cat. And maybe my mum would come in sometimes and not enjoy what she was listening to.
It's interesting that you talk about your voice that way. When I first heard the song Feel So Close, I would never have imagined a white kid from Scotland being the voice behind that song. I feel so close to you right now. It's a force field. How did you sort of discover your voice and the voice that you now sing in?
By, you know, maybe 12 years of trying to make my voice sound good in the studio, I finally learned how to do that. or as good as it could be, you know, so that was what that song was. There's still a very limited range there, which is why I like working with other people, especially female singers, because they suit dance music a lot better. There's only so much you can do with a male voice in dance music.
One of the female singers you work with is Florence Welch, the lead singer from Florence and the Machine, who has this incredibly powerful voice. You took my heart. Have her featured in a song called Sweet Nothing.
Yeah, she's incredible. I was chasing her to do a track for about 2 years. She's an amazing front woman, but she'd never done a dance record before, but I just really, really didn't want her to do one with someone else if she was ever going to do one. So I chased her and eventually convinced her. It's definitely my favourite track on the album.
Such an amazing song. It's produced by DJ Calvin Harris. His new record is called 18 Months. Calvin, I lived in the UK for many years, and electronic music was always part of the mainstream there, unlike here in the US. But that's changed in recent years. I mean, you turn on the radio now, and you hear these sounds in almost every pop song, and you have big-name producers and DJs like David Guetta and yourself involved in that process. How do you explain that? How did that come about?
One of the biggest bands in America, biggest pop bands in America at the time, was Black Eyed Peas, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And will.i.am had an obsession with European dance music, and he wanted to work with the DJs that were making it and make some for the Black Eyed Peas. He saw it as a futuristic experiment. So he worked with David Guetta for I Got a Feeling. Also, Lady Gaga came along and she was making 4/4 music.
4/4, you mean 4/4?
4/4, I mean by 4/4, like 4/4. The beat, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than hip-hop, which was also unusual. And those two records came along at the same time, and when radio started playing them at the same time and people liked them, it was kind of a snowball effect. And everybody wanted to make that kind of music.
Give us a sense of how you produce a song, like break it apart for us. So this song is Let's Go, which features Neo. And as I say, if someone's listening to this in the gym right now, it's not coming from the speakers, it's coming from your headphones from NPR. So let's take a listen to Let's Go for a bit. Let's go, make no excuses now. I'm talking here and now, I'm talking here and now. Let's go. How many of these sounds are synthetic and how many of them are real?
In this particular track, it's probably about 50-50. The main synth riff is about 10 different instruments playing at the same time.
And you're playing all of them?
Yeah, I mean, all of these instruments here are played by me.
So you make most of this music in a computer. I mean, Neo goes to a studio, he sings, but aside from that, there isn't really much need for a studio, I guess, right?
I mean, there is for the monitors and for the fact that I'm playing guitars and basses. I can't make any of my records in front of a laptop, you know. I can't make records on the road. I need to play instruments. That's where I differ from a lot of producers, actually. And that's kind of what helps the sound and make it a little bit more full. You know, like on Feel So Close, there isn't a single synthetic instrument on there.
That whole song is live instrumentation.
Well, yeah, it's as live as any indie band or rock band, because all their stuff runs off computer as well.
I was looking at the video for Feel So Close, and it's had 49 million hits on YouTube. I mean, you're a kid from Dumfries in Scotland. a place that you say was the middle of nowhere. Do you ever think about that? Do you ever just think 49 million people have seen that song and had all these hits?
No, I never think that. No, I don't. It feels great that it got so popular, but I see it as luck as well as hard work.
That's DJ and producer Calvin Harris. His new record is called 18 Months. Calvin Harris, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Ending December 9th, 2012. That's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. Our staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Amy Held, Lily Percy, Acacia Squire, Sarah Ventry, and Chris Connolly. Our intern is Barbara Sprunt. The technical director is Melissa Marquis. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in.